Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. Last week, we began looking at the first part of two parts of Goethe's Faust, the great work of German literature, which is based on the medieval German legend of a man who sold his soul to the devil in exchange for whatever he desired, whatever he wished for. That legend traveled after the Middle Ages over to England and produced Christopher Marlowe's stage play, Dr. Faustus, somewhere around 1590, Shakespeare's time. Goethe did not know Marlowe's Dr. Faustus until he had been working on his own version for close to 20 years or so. But nevertheless, the legend returned to Germany and was picked up by Goethe, who worked on it for most of his lifetime. But in Goethe's version, what Faust desires is not the usual wish fulfillment stuff. Not wine, women, and song, not wealth, women, and power. In Goethe's hands, it becomes linked to the theme that runs through European literature of forbidden knowledge. Faust is a man of knowledge. He is, in fact, an academic. And in the opening soliloquy that we looked at last week, there are no acts or scenes in part one, only scenes that are designated by various titles. And we opened with the first one titled Night. And the first part of that scene consists of a soliloquy by Faust saying, I am in midlife as a supposedly successful academic. I am a professor at the university. I have mastered all four of the branches of knowledge of a medieval university, philosophy, theology, medicine, law, and find that it is all empty and worthless. There is nothing we can know. Knowledge is not really knowledge. So therefore, he turns to another type of knowledge, which is magic and the whole esoteric tradition that will later reach out in Faust to include the discipline of alchemy. But here, he opens a magic book, which is not quite yet into the realm of forbidden knowledge, because, as I said last week, Faust belongs to the tradition of the magus figure, a figure of universal learning in the Renaissance, part of what we mean when we say Renaissance man, of knowing all branches of learning, not just the ones that we named in the German university, but in the humanistic tradition, it would include things such as classical learning, the beginnings of science, and magical lore, which was not all entirely forbidden, at least not in every quarter. There was a distinction made, at least among humanists, between white magic and black magic. White magic, exemplified by a figure like Prospero in Shakespeare's drama The Tempest. Prospero is a white magician. The spirits he summons and commands are spirits of nature, of the elements. And that was not strictly forbidden in the Renaissance tradition. Demonic spirits are something else again. What happens in Night, the opening scene of part one, is that Faust despairs of ordinary academic learning, turns to magic, looks in a magic book, sees an emblem of a third type of spirit, celestial spirits. He has a vision caused by the emblem of the macrocosm, a vision of transcendent cosmic order, something that evokes imagery comparable to Dante's Paradiso, with celestial spirits who could not be conjured. They are simply beyond the ability of earthly magicians to master. They are in the realm of angels and whatnot. So Faust finds that vision beautiful, but out of his reach. It is transcendent, it is beyond human capacity. So he turns to a second emblem and conjures with it the earth spirit, the Erdgeist. None of this is in the original Faust legend, which Goethe has expanded enormously. The earth spirit appears, but Faust is not up to that either. This is a spirit of the earth, of the life inherent in earth, but Faust is not even up to that. He cowers in sheer terror at the power of the earth spirit, who dismisses him with contempt. Faust tries to claim, "I feel close to you," and the earth spirit says contemptuously, "You are close to the spirit you comprehend, not to me," and disappears. The spirit you comprehend is the third realm, the demonic realm. Soon, Mephistopheles will appear. But before that, we have a long interlude. First, Faust is utterly crushed. He pulls himself off of the floor, but he is in despair. He sees a glass full of poison on the shelf, takes it down, and is on the verge of drinking a kind of fatal communion of poison when suddenly the festivities of Easter burst from outside. All of the singing and hallelujahs of people celebrating Easter, night has turned to midnight and has gone over into the next day, Easter Sunday, and there is joy of celebration outside his windows, which distracts him and to some degree changes his mood, deflects it from suicidal despair. Goethe did not identify himself as a Christian, and in fact was usually pretty satiric, pretty ironic about the German Protestant Orthodox tradition. But it is too quick to say that he was simply a non-Christian, much less an anti-Christian, because, of course, what does he choose here to base his greatest work upon but a legend that comes out of the Christian tradition, a pact with the devil, ending in traditionally damnation, though in Goethe's case, Goethe's Faust will eventually be saved. And if Goethe is not a Christian, what does all this mean? Why employ this framework? What I would suggest is that what Goethe is looking for, Goethe is not simply an atheist by any means. He is a quester. He is looking for something, and that something includes spiritual aspirations over and over again. But the aspirations do not fit within the traditional Christian framework, which at this point, at the period of the Romantic Revolution in culture in which Goethe lived, that was a common feeling that Christianity was, if not just worn out, in bad need of a makeover. It needed to be changed to fit the conditions of modern understanding and sensibility. And the old conventional Orthodox framework is simply inadequate. And Faust could be regarded as one example of one approach to doing that, to expand Christian mythology beyond its old theological framework to include all sorts of new types of experiences and knowledge, which would include, as we will see, classical mythology. Goethe was far from the only figure to employ classical as well as Christian imagery. That had been true all the way back to the Renaissance, to Renaissance paintings and sculptors like Michelangelo and Botticelli. Also, the esoteric traditions, as I say, of magic and alchemy, which were by no means universally disapproved of. People like Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages believed in, with necessary qualifications, astrology, alchemy, and certain types of magic. There is also the beginnings growing out of that tradition of what would quickly become genuine science. And in addition to that, a feeling that the material world and the feminine had been devalued and needed to be worked back into a living mythology for our time, because Goethe lived in what amounts to our time in modern times. And what the modern world is looking for is an expanded mythology that will contain all of that instead of focusing on certain narrow elements and declaring everything else heretical. And you can see that reflected in the vast heterogeneous imagery and knowledge of Goethe's Faust. He was by no means the only romantic writer or poet looking for an expanded vision that would include more than the old conventional Christianity. Whether you call that transformed mythology Christian still or not is a matter of opinion. But at any rate, we have a poet, Goethe, employing a medieval Christian legend to do something that expands far beyond the usual confines. And here we have Easter deflects Faust. Faust is not clearly, judging by his speeches, a believer. And yet the feelings involved, the joy of the people who do believe that Christ is resurrected and that we are redeemed and that today, Easter Sunday, is a joyous day, he finds that evokes a nostalgia for the innocence of his childhood when he did believe that. And it shakes him out of his mood. Then his assistant, he has a student assistant, and this goes back into the original Faust legend, named Wagner, who is also into learning and is still quite enthusiastic about learning, as his master is not. Though, as we will find, Wagner uses his learning for egocentric purposes. Learning to him is knowledge for the sake of a certain type of superiority. And that begins to manifest itself in the next scene. He collects Faust and says, "Hey, come on out of your dark, dusty study and come out. Let's walk outside. Everybody's out celebrating Easter morning." And that leads to the next scene, which is called Outside the City Gate. And the first part of it does consist of a heterogeneous crowd scene where people are talking and laughing, all walks of common life, just nameless people listed in terms of the fragmentary dialogue by their walk of life. An apprentice, another apprentice, a servant girl, a student, a girl of the burgher class, a citizen, and so forth, even a beggar singing a begging song, all of these celebrating Easter. It's a festive occasion. Faust responds to some degree to just a feeling of that. These are the common people. He also responds to the natural scene around them and makes a rather vivid short speech about the fact that it's spring and everything is being reborn in nature. Freed from the ice are brooks and rivers in spring's enchanting, enlivening gaze. The valley is blithe with hope's green haze, and so on. Wagner is not moved by any of it because Wagner has his nose in the air. All of this is vulgar and common. He replies, well, but on my own, I would not stray here ever, because I shun all that is unrefined. How I abominate these vulgar revels. A very different attitude, and if you know what happens later in Faust and where Wagner's life and career take him, you see that attitude continues as he develops. We meet him much later, years later, when he has long graduated from being simply the master's assistant and is a master scholar in his own right. And in fact, he sticks with a certain type of knowledge. It is Wagner who will create the artificial man, the homunculus, in part two of Faust, making him very comparable to Victor Frankenstein in the English tradition. Frankenstein also wants the secret of life, but is determined to do it by new scientific means rather than the old alchemical means. Wagner sticks with the old alchemy and apparently succeeds, which is interesting because Goethe is trying to sift through the very disparate tradition of alchemy. Faust is alchemical from start to finish, but in a very complex way. Goethe does not regard alchemy simply as an outmoded superstition beginning to be superseded by the development of modern science. Goethe was in fact interested in both alchemy and science and did experiments in both, and they were not entirely separate during that period of time. Goethe's Faust does not despise alchemy, but despises a certain type of alchemy. And unfortunately, it is the type that some old people come up to Faust and Wagner here outside the city gates and say, oh, hello, doctor, we hardly see you outside your study. We want to express once again our gratitude. And they launch into a speech thanking Faust and his father. They refer to a time, not dramatized in the story, but referred to in the past, when there was a plague that was treated by Faust's father, who was a doctor slash alchemist, and Faust was his young assistant, and the old people revere both the memory of Faust's father and Faust himself. They think that they were miracle workers who saved them. And after these old people depart, Faust makes a bitter speech saying, we were frauds. And whatever is true of his father, Faust knew they were frauds. The alchemy was worthless. It was a con job. It did no good at all. It's just that the ignorant people thought that it did. Given our own recent experiences with the pandemic and people recommending, including the former president of the United States, all sorts of quack cures that they thought worked, we find ourselves in very familiar territory at this moment, at this scene. But that type of false medicine, alchemy as a kind of false medicine, was one type of alchemy, but not the only type. In part two, we will find another type of false alchemy, another type of con job, alchemy as a process of making gold. And again, we have analogs in our time. We have cryptocurrency. Faust and Mephistopheles will work for the Holy Roman Emperor, creating a crisis or resolving a crisis about the need for gold, based on, again, alchemical tradition of making gold. Ben Jonson, in Shakespeare's time, has a caustic satire called The Alchemist about this type of alchemist. So there are fake doctors, there are fake makers of gold, but there is also a more genuine alchemy, and Wagner does stick with it, and as I say, actually does produce artificial life in part two. So we're putting things into place here. It's a fascinatingly complex play, but also a very lively one. It is rather puzzling in a way that Faust is not more known and more popular in the English-speaking world. Part of that is the unfortunate accident of history. Faust got identified as the great product of German nationalism, even though Goethe had no patience whatsoever with any kind of German nationalism. But the nationalistic tradition, which began to grow after Germany actually became a nation in 1871, regarded Faust as the quintessential German poem, and its doctrine of striving was used to rationalize German striving in a way that, as we know, turned out rather sinister. But Goethe's Faust has nothing to do with any of that. It would be decades before Germany was even a nation at this point, although it did regard itself as a unified culture. Goethe always spoke not of German literature, but of world literature and world theater. And his sights were always set on creating a work that would make a German example that belonged in a world tradition of literature and especially drama. And rejecting the false alchemy of quack medicine, Faust goes on to make one of the famous set speeches in part one of Faust. Wagner has very practical concerns, and they will serve him well in terms of being the kind of success that he wants. But he doesn't begin to understand that his master Faust has aspirations far beyond that, aspirations that Wagner simply does not understand. By such an urge, Wagner says, I was never driven, because Faust has been speaking about a type of yearning that he has. And it is a yearning for the transcendent. And out of this yearning erupts, as they say, one of the famous set speeches. Faust says this to him, you are by just a single urge possessed. Oh, may you never know the other. Two souls, alas, are dwelling in my breast, and either would be severed from its brother. The one holds fast with joyous earthy lust unto the world of man with organs clinging. The other soars impassioned from the dust to realms of lofty forebears winging, and goes on to speak, "Oh, there are spirits in the air." The yearning upward, but an equal but opposite yearning downwards towards the earthly. And the theme of striving in Faust is never free of that doubleness, of that polarity, expressed in terms of the mythological axis mundi, the vertical axis of being that ascends upward towards the spiritual, downwards towards first the earthly, and then continuing downward into the underworldly. And sure enough, careful what you wish for, because Faust happens to notice at this point, the end of this scene, "Oh, see that black dog through seed and fallow roaming?" And Wagner says, "A poodle, I should say. A black dog follows them." And it will turn out, as you could probably guess, to be Mephistopheles in disguise. Unlike God, the devil usually shows up when you call for him, even if you only call for him implicitly by the form of your yearnings. And he appears here disguised as a black dog. I have never understood, honestly, why a poodle? If you are going to have a demonic dog, a dog that is the vehicle of the devil himself, a poodle? Why not an Irish wolfhound or something that you would see as appropriately demonic? But poodle it is, and it may simply be part of the constantly satiric aspect of Faust. One of the things that makes me love Goethe's Faust so much is its satiric liveliness, its exuberance, similar to the satiric side of Blake in English literature. And it's a constant thing in Faust. And it may be simply that what you get if you're Faust in terms of a temptation is a poodle. At any rate, they return to Faust's study, and the poodle comes in with Faust. Wagner departs, and Faust is once again alone in his study. The poodle is restless. Faust is trying to think and contemplate. The whole business of yearning and having two souls in his breast has gotten him into one of his moods again. But he keeps being distracted by the poodle. "Where are you running, poodle? Cease your riot. Why snuffle at the threshold for outdoors?" And as it will turn out, the poodle is trapped. Mephistopheles has accidentally trapped himself because he hasn't realized that inside on the floor of the study is a pentagram, the thing that is used to cage and trap demonic spirits or spirits of any sort conjured. Meanwhile, Faust is once again turning to his books, and he opens a tome and sets forth, the stage direction says. But this one is a book that quotes the opening of the Gospel of John. "In the beginning was the Word." And we enter here upon another famous set passage of Faust. "In the beginning was the Word," the opening of the Gospel of John, the fourth Gospel. And Faust cannot accept that. Word, I've spent my life with words. They're meaningless. I cannot grant the word such sovereign merit. So Faust departs from orthodoxy, from the approved belief system. I must translate it in a different way. And he tries out various translations for logos in the original Greek of John. In the beginning was the sense, in the meaning of the meaning of a word and not the word itself. That doesn't work for him either. It's a little better though. Is sense, in fact, all actions spur and source? No, it should read, in the beginning was the force. Is moving away from word towards something that involves action, power, and will, and finally arrives famously in an often quoted line at what satisfies him. In the beginning was the deed or the act, the preference for something that is active and involved with will, power, and striving, rather than the word, as Faust is thinking of it, as an empty container. That is not what the word is in the Gospel of John. Faust is not comprehending, which is an irony, because the passage in John goes on to say that the darkness comprehended it not. And Faust does not comprehend it. He mistranslates it. The word in John is a word of creative power. It echoes the opening of Genesis, in which God created by the word. But Faust is looking for something else, and by doing so, is headed away from Christian tradition into dangerous territory, as signified by the very next line, "Poodle, stop your barking." But he keeps looking at the poodle, and something strange starts going on. My poodle grows long and broad. What have I brought to the house, an incubus? By now, it's like a hippopotamus, some hellish brood. And he begins trying to conjure it, to control it. And he tries because, as I say, Renaissance magic, white magic, was nature magic. He begins trying to conjure it by the spirits of the four elements and the four living creatures that embodied the four elements. He tries with the spell of the four, let salamander flare. Salamanders were supposed to have lived in fire. Undine recoil, a sea creature, sylph thin to air, hobgoblin of the earth toil. None of these work. None of these four is the brute's core. And, well, if you aren't nature spirits, might you be tell a truant from hell? Well, let's try that out. See this sign. And he shows him the sign of the cross. And that works. Mephistopheles is apparently more or less forced to appear as his real self. And the stage direction says, Mephistopheles, clothed like a medieval traveling student, steps forth from behind the stove as the vapor clears. And his first words in the play itself, as opposed to the prologue, are, "Why all the fuss? What's my lord's pleasure, pray?" The slightly supercilious sarcasm in the tone, very characteristic of Mephistopheles all the way through. Mephistopheles is one of the truly vivid creations of Faust. And Faust says, "Who are you then?" And Mephistopheles answers, speaking of the prologue, "Part of that force which would do ever evil and does ever good," which is exactly how he was designated by God himself in the prologue in heaven. And this means that Mephistopheles actually understands that everything he does will come out against what he wishes and tries for. He tries to do evil, even knowing at the time that it will turn out to be good. And this is the Faust version of the doctrine of the fortunate fall, that humanity in that case perpetrated evil, but God turned it. And this is Christian doctrine. Read Paradise Lost, as Milton had, as Goethe had. God will turn it into a greater good than if we had not done evil. Here, I try to do evil and do ever good. And Faust says, and that conundrum of a phrase implies, what are you talking about? So Mephistopheles goes on into a mythological explanation of the kind of spirit he is, the spirit which eternally denies, and justly so, for all that which is wrought deserves that it should come to naught. Hence it were best if nothing were engendered, which is why all things you have rendered by terms like sin, destruction, evil, in brief, are my true element in chief. I am the spirit that denies, which again matches the prologue in heaven where he is referred to as the spirit of negation, and goes on to say, I am that which feels that nothing should exist. It were best if nothing were engendered. I am a spirit of would-be destruction. And goes on to say, I am but part of the part that was the whole at first, part of the dark. I am part of the darkness, and the darkness came first. It was the original condition, and out of that came the light. And that, in his opinion, was a mistake. Faust has conjured something dangerous, a spirit of negation. But as he will come to understand, he needs that. Now it is truly within the realm of forbidden knowledge. Mephistopheles is going to give him a type of knowledge that is dangerous, demonic, destructive. And yet it is something that Faust, in a strange way that we will have to wrestle with, Faust needs. And we will go on to explore that and the famous pact with the devil, which follows next time.